on the stage and giving him a chance at his long career as an Irish tenor soloist in this country. Today, he had three children, two daughters and a son, who continued, that's wrong. Can you erase a little bit of that?
Why don't you just say, well, correct myself.
Okay. All goes in here.
Yes.
All right. I am wrong in saying that. E. Kirkhart had two sons and three daughters. The daughters all married and moved away from here. The two sons continued in Albion. And in my childhood, the younger son, owned the house on the southeast corner of Main and East Avenue. And the older son, Charles Ehart, lived in this almost mansion. In the beginning, it had a low stone wall along the street. It had a very beautiful fountain in the front yard, a little boy and girl under an umbrella. It was really a beautiful thing and most unusual. There was a big carriage house in the backyard there, and it ran through, the whole property ran through to Liberty Street. And I can't quite picture it now or know why, but I know that there was a low windmill in that backyard in my early childhood. And then, of course, you get down to the Park Street corners, and I believe it was in 1895 that George Pullman, whose father had come here as a cabinet maker, came back from his success at building sleeping cars in Chicago and built the Pullman Church as a memorial to his parents. If you haven't seen it, it would be wise to go into the entrance of that church someday and see the very handsome bas-reliefs of his parents that are in the entranceway of that church. My grandmother Hart had the conviction of being a Universalist, but the Harts had been early Presbyterians. In fact, it was the first Joseph Hart who was one of the founders of what is now the Barry Center Presbyterian Church. And when the village of Albion came about in 1824, he and his wife removed their allegiance from Barry Center and were among the founders of the present Presbyterian Church in Albion. My grandmother, Hart, felt that her daughters, the grandchildren of these Presbyterians, should be brought up in the Presbyterian faith. And at that time, the Presbyterian, or the Universalist Church in Childs, seldom had a pastor, so she took her daughters to the Albion Presbyterian Church and brought them into the fold of that church. But when the Pullman Church was organized in Albion, Grandmother was one of the organizing group in that church. And on the day of its dedication, which was 31st of January, 1895, the day that my parents were married, it was said that she spent the day at the dedicatory services of the church and then came back to her home where there was an 8 o'clock formal wedding. Had a good laugh about that. Across from the Pullman Church, one of our fine architects in this area had built the brick house, which is today the rectory for St. Joseph's Church. And then coming north into the block, across from the courthouse square, we have the little Episcopal Church, which in our history was founded and was the first Presbyterian church in the village. And in 1846, when the Presbyterians had outgrown it and the Episcopalians had bought a lot on the north side of East State Street, but had no money with which to build a building. A swap was made, the Presbyterians taking over the building site, and the Episcopalians having a church. The Presbyterians built what is now the chapel of the present Presbyterian Church. It once had a belfry on it and was a real church. If you go inside now, or rather from the outside, if you look, you will see that the windows on the side of that building extend over two stories. And when it was no longer used as the church, a floor was put in halfway across those windows, making it a two-story building. I believe there was always a basement kitchen and a dining room in the early days. Those have been moved now to the ground floor. The building, which is now the Swan Library, was the home of one of the Burroughs family, of the early Burroughs who came into this community. And on the southwest corner of State and Main, there was another brick house, always painted yellow as I remember it, which had belonged to a druggist, a Mr. Burrell, whose daughter was Keziah, and it was the first time I ever met that name, and it intrigued me as a youngster. The Baptists had a church. Their first church was north of the Burroughs home, but it had been raised before I can remember it, and the present Baptist edifice had been built. But there was a low brick house a bit farther north, south of what is now the Cooper home, and in front of that was a little brick, a Greek Revival type building, which had been a lawyer's office. I remember it as a milliner shop. Across from that, there was a long, low, two-story white wooden building, which was a hotel in my earliest childhood days. At the village itself, the buildings are very much as I remember them. But when you get to the canal bridge, I remember distinctly when the canal was widened the last time, and the present lift bridge was installed. Before that, we had had a narrow two-lane bridge, in the middle of which there was a strange iron wall. And when the bridge needed to be opened, it was not raised, but was turned, or, as the expression was, swung. There was a man who swung the bridge. And he came out with a heavy wooden stick that had a metal on the end of it that fitted into this ball, and by walking round and round, he turned that bridge so that it was parallel to the canal and the boats could go through on either side. To be sure, the boats were narrower at that time, must have been. And of course, I distinctly remember at that time, the boats going through being drawn by mules or horses, and the towpath where the animals walked being in use. The next thing I remember going down Main Street would be the large brick house, I believe it is, and square house on the west side of the street. There were other houses in through there, and that had been the first convent, because when the Catholic Society came into this area, they built their first church on the east side of Main Street in that block between Caroline and what is now Erie Street. And in back of that, they had a school, the first parochial school in this village. And then, of course, the two houses, the one that is now the three-story Lions Clubhouse on the west side of the street, built of gray Medina sandstone, and the present brick building on the east side of the street, which we commonly speak of as the boroughs, as the DAR house, were there very much as they are today. What is now the DAR house was occupied by Mrs. Church, the great-grandmother of the present Lawyer Church in this village. Her father had come out of Clarendon and been one of the men who had made money, and in some of the widenings of the canal, and decided to make Albion his home. And so he had bought that stone brick house on the east side of the street. And about 1855, he had enlarged it to practically its present size, except that there were long sheds, woodshed type of buildings at the back. That continued. His name was Orson Towsley, and it was his wife who married Mr. Church and was living there with a companion in my childhood. At her death, it went to her son, and he already had a comfortable home just north of it and didn't want the brick house. The DAR had been organized in the community some 4 years before, and the women of that organization met in private homes for their monthly meetings. A woman who had grown up in Albion was a native of Orleans County. Emma Reed had married and gone to Utica, New York, as the wife of a dentist, Nelson. He had died, and she had Albion ties, relatives in this area, was very much interested in DAR, had a great quantity of the treasures that her family had cherished from the time and before they had come into Orleans County. And she felt that those keepsakes, mementos, should come back into the county. So she broached this young organization and said, if I bought a house and made it habitable as a clubhouse, would you take care of a small museum in which I would place my treasures? And so the deal was made. And it was in 1929, I believe, that the present DAR house was dedicated. Mrs. Webster didn't live too long after that. She had high hopes of doing more for the organization. In the meantime, she married a boyhood sweetheart from Albion who had gone to Long Island to live. Mr. Webster. They came back and bought a summer home up on farther west on the ridge. Today it is a private dwelling home right next to a little Quaker cemetery. I think that's the easiest way I can describe it for you. The DAR has continued. It has increased its museum a bit. It still occupies the second floor of the building. It is with difficulty that the organization has been able to keep up the property. This past year of 1979, they did find that they could afford to redecorate the club rooms on the first floor, and we're happy to say that at the moment the property is in very good shape. It is an organization that does not, in this vicinity, attract young people as it does in the South, which is rather too bad, but perhaps even the South is changing now that so many more women are going into business and there are two workers in a family. I have seen that whole area back of the DAR house developed in my lifetime. Linwood Avenue is all built up within my time. My grandparents, Billings, came and left the farm about 1908 and came into the village. And because grandfather had always driven by way of Caroline Street in his horse and buggy, and he was a daily visitor in the village, they bought the old house on the northeast corner of Caroline and Ingersoll Street. It had been, I believe, a two-family house. It is today a two-family house, but my grandparents occupied it as one family, and it was there that my grandfather died in 1913, and grandmother continued to live there until the early 1930s. Lived in Indianapolis, Indiana, and grandmother used to go there and spend her winters with my aunt. And then, for the very last years, it seemed too much for her to go back and forth spring and fall, and so she continued to live in Indianapolis until 1939, when she passed away in June, having survived her daughter by 3 years. Grandmother was approaching her 94th birthday, had she been able to live until the September following her death. Grandfather, of course, had been a farmer all his life on the ridge. He had been one of the first to go into fruit and had one of the first peach orchards, I remember, and some of the juiciest and most delicious peaches I ever ate came off that farm. And that reminds me of another story. My father used to tell me about the Billings peach, a white peach, and he said that a man had come across Lake Ontario from Canada, someone who was escaping the law, and had beached somewhere at the end of the Kent Road, had walked up with these white peaches in his pocket. That's what he'd had to eat on his trip across the lake. And he gave some of the peach stones to Grandfather Billings's older brother, Harlow, who was living to the east of our farm. And so Billings peach was developed there. We know nothing about it. It's nothing that has ever been sold commercially, yes, but you know that the corner, our corners of the Kent Road and the Ridge Road, Route 104 today, was known as East Gaines. And in my childhood, there was still a grocery store. It has been said that our roads and streets have changed a bit, and that has set me to thinking. When I was a youngster, there wasn't a paved street in the village of Albion. The lift bridge at Main Street hadn't, over the canal, hadn't yet been built. There has been a new high bridge on Brown Street put in perhaps 50, 55 years ago. But back at Main Street, it used to be that we had what was called a swing bridge. That meant that it was a two-lane bridge with a funny round iron knob about in the middle of it. And when a boat approached, and the canal boats were then pulled by mules and the towpath was in use, a bridgeman came out and did what we called swing the bridge. He brought a long pole with some sort of an iron on the end of it that fitted into the iron in the center of the bridge, and then he walked round and round until the bridge had turned to be parallel with the canal. And the boats at that time had to be narrow enough that they would go either one side or the other side of the bridge as it was there in the middle of things. And that made me think, too, that as a youngster, we never went to Batavia the way we do today, following 98, as it is. Some of you have heard the expression Old 98, I'm sure, or the Oak Orchard Road, which it is. And south of Barry Center, the road branches to the left, as well as the road that goes straight ahead. And it was always the left fork that we took at that point. It seems roundabout to us today, but it is a higher road than the present 98. And therefore, they followed the old Indian trail. And the land where we now have muck land along Route 98 was swamp and heavily forested. It wasn't until I was perhaps 15, 18 years old that a New York company came in, built barracks over on Old 98, and bought up that land and started in the draining and clearing of that swamp area. And anyone who's driven through knows that there are drainage ditches through there. Those were all made by that company. And then the road was dried out enough so that everyone began to go straight ahead and through Barry and on beyond. And of course, what we call Quaker Hill now is greatly cut down. Before I can remember it, I'm sure the road went over the top of that hill without any gouging down in, as it is today. And of course, 98, the old 98, was the Indian Trail, which these first settlers into this area followed when they came to Batavia first to stake out a claim for land, then came over to their land, and they were following the trail that the Indians had used when they came in the spring to fish at the mouth of Oak Orchard Creek. And that isn't the road that we know today either, because their road wound around hitting high spots, wound around through Gaines, and on down past the left fork of the road or turn that would take you into Waterport. And going straight on, you finally make a turn to the left onto what is known as Park Avenue. But if you went straight ahead across the field, you can still see remains of something of a dugout road at one time, and that was the fording space in Oak Orchard Creek, and everybody drove or rode their horses through without need of a bridge at that time. Then coming back into Albion, as I said before, they were all dirt streets. I am old enough to remember when East and West Avenue and all of Main Street was paved for the first time, and it was paved with brick. That was the hard surface that was put on, and it was a slow, tedious job of seeing that done. And it was not very practical because the bricks gave way, and it had been a highly expensive thing. Going back up South Main Street, if you stop and think, there is the large brick house on the left-hand side of the street going south, where Dr. Anthony Nasarno lives, and the older, much older, brick house of federal design on the right-hand side. Today, there are lawns cut down considerably to the level of the street. Originally, the road went over the top of that rise. And it was the Hart family that lived on the left-hand side, owned that land, and that was known to the whole community as Hart's Hill. And people went up on the hill to see Mr. Hart. It was said at the time they put in the brick pavement that in digging down and widening the road, they found remains of old, hollowed-out logs which had been the first surface water ditches
system,
you might say, in the village of Albia. And when it comes to sidewalks, I'm so old that I can remember that there were a few around the courthouse square and in other parts of the village that were slabs of sandstone which were used for sidewalks. But aside from that, they were wooden sidewalks here in the village. And that meant that there was, well, it's like a railroad. There were heavy boards on either side and cross boards with a bit of space in between for the water to run down through to dry them out. And they were wonderful for women to wheel their baby carriages over. In fact, there was one on East Avenue for a number of years that one woman with an English perambulator always brought her children because she didn't have to jingle the carriage. That way, the baby got all the jouncing it needed. And I learned to roller skate on Platt Street where there was a wooden sidewalk. And one day I became quite daring and thought I could go to the railroad track. And I got up a little bit too much steam and went a bit too fast. And then when I came to the railroad ties and rails, I collapsed on the track, and it really rather frightened me because I thought there might have been a train coming. There were no signals at Platt Street at that time. And perhaps that's another thing. At the railroad crossings on Main Street and at Clinton Street, we had to have a flagman 24 hours a day. And there were little round or square houses where they might seek refuge out of the cold or the wind when they were not busy flagging down the passengers to let the trains go through. And of course there were many more trains in that time because we had about six trains, Albion. I say we, but Albion had about six trains a day each way. And so it was nice to get the 7:20 or the 9:10 or the 11:20 or the 12:30 and so on through the day into Rochester. And you could come back equally comfortably at the hour you were to choose. It wasn't until perhaps 1915 that an Englishman, John Bowles, going back to sidewalks, brought his art of laying concrete walks into the village. And today, some of the walks that are standing up the best and have shown the least wear and tear have his name stamped in the corner of a block, perhaps at one end, perhaps at each end. And people used to spend their afternoons, Sunday afternoons especially, strolling. And so, at village expense, a concrete sidewalk was built all the way from the edge of the village to Mount Albion. And as a child living on East Avenue, I was very much accustomed to seeing whole families stroll by, and we always knew that they were taking a walk to the cemetery, which was quite the proper thing to do at that time. Good place to stand. Let it go and go.
Oh, there's more.
There is more. All right. That walk is completely wiped out in places now. In fact, probably half of the walk is gone. And people wonder why in the world it was ever placed there. But it really served a very important need for its day. In other parts of the village, sidewalks were laid, and every landowner had to provide the walk in front of his own home and keep it shoveled in the winter time and his lawn mowed in the summertime, and expected to sweep that sidewalk once in a while so that it was kept in quite respectable condition. Perhaps I should have said, when I was talking about the Indian Trail becoming the first road of the settlers, that in low spots, farmers or anyone who wished could put logs in the road to build it up. It came to be called a log road or a plank road, and they had the right to put a toll booth at one end and collect a small toll for the privilege of driving over this road and not taking the chance of having their wagon wheels mired in quicksand or in soft mud. I think that finishes on that. When it comes to the early schools in the village of Albion, of course there were nothing but grade schools, no high schools, because they were not demanded by the public. The very first school was the old people of New England would have called a dame school, because it was kept by a woman in her own home, and she could watch over these children as she was doing her housework. In time, Albion had three schools. There was one built of sandstone on Bailey Avenue, which we know as West Avenue today, and that still stands on the north side of the street, almost across from the Ames Plaza. Another was on the corner of Clarendon and East State Street, and the last I knew, there was still a millstone set back in the yard of the house there that marked the spot where that school used to be. Of course, they were one-room schools, and all facilities were outside for many, many years. There was a third school down on Caroline Street, somewhere east of Ingersoll Street. Then in time, the brick building at the southwest corner of Platt and Park Street was built. And that became a school where children were gathered from two or three of these districts. And by that time, high school education or higher education had come into vogue, but it was still privately controlled. And there was what was known as a boys' academy, which today is the site of the office building of our public school system, between East and West, the first year I entered school in Albion. And the school children were, by that time, of course, it had become the old building that the present gray stone structure followed was a brick building, and that had been the Boys' Academy, which in time was taken over by the village of Albion when high school public education became mandatory. For the girls, there had been Phipps Seminary on the privately owned girls' school on the of what is now the Courthouse Square. And that building, or school rather, attracted girls from as far away as Alabama and Georgia. And some from the Midwest came here. It was both a boarding and a day school. and because their boarding facilities were rather limited, some of the girls lived in private homes, boarded in private homes here in the village. And then there was another woman who maintained in her home a day school for girls. At the moment, not having looked it up, I can't think of her name. But when the high school became a public high school, then both boys and girls were accepted in the same school. The building where I began, which is now the about to be abandoned American Legion building, was known as the Central School. And at the time I began school, all the children on the east side of Main Street went there for the first 3 or 4 grades. And then the building that was built the year I started school was large enough to house not only the high school, but what they called a preparatory department of 2 rooms, I believe, where the children who came in from the rural country schools could sort of catch up on what they needed and then be ready to enter high school in 1 or 2 years. And all of the grades from 5 through 8 were held in that building or met in that building. A funny thing, perhaps, or perhaps I should say a peculiar thing happened. By that time, it had become mandatory for a teacher to have a witness if there was a whipping in school. And there was one boy, when I was in the 4th grade, who was incorrigible, or seemingly so. And on one occasion, because I was oversized in every way for my age, I was invited to take the place of the adult to be the witness to the whipping. And he happened to be my next door neighbor. And he thought it was the funniest thing. He certainly got no help from that whipping because he was so amused at the fact that I was witnessing it. And I was so embarrassed, I didn't know what to do. The day I entered the big building between the Academy streets, I had met with another 5th grade girl and we went over together like babes in the wood. And it seemed so big and we felt so strange and we didn't see a person we knew and we didn't know where to go. And we had heard that there was a 5A and a 5B room. We knew there were to be 2 fifth grades. And the first person that we recognized was the superintendent of schools, Mr. Carmer. And so we must have rushed up to him and said, "Where is 5B? And of course we didn't know that that was a non-permitted expression in his life. There was no A and B fifth grade. They were just the same. And so he personally escorted us to a 5th grade. And the teacher standing in the door was instructed that we were 2 of her new pupils. There wasn't a person in that room we knew. They were all strange children to us. And we didn't dare say anything. And so for my 5th and 6th grades, I was isolated from all the youngsters I had grown up with through the other grades. They thought it was hilariously funny, and I came to make very good friends, lifelong friends, in the new 5th grade, but for the first week or two it was. And then our school, I believe I'm right in saying that children could leave school and have working papers at 14 at that time. So that the school was considerably decreased inside when it got to the 7th grade. And so there was only 1 7th grade and 1 8th grade. And at that time we had a very excellent and superior 8th grade teacher, the kind of a teacher of whom we were all scared to death. But she could prod us through, and those of us who had special ability or seemed to get along a little faster than others were permitted to take algebra, straight algebra at that time, or and even sometimes Latin when we were in eighth grade to get started toward high school. That was when I first came to know Miss Sadie Britton, who at this moment is still a resident of Albion. Miss Britton graduated from Cornell after 3.5 years of college and came home in mid-year to teach math in Albion High School. I thought she was one of the most beautiful people I had ever seen, with her red hair and her great vivacity, and wearing, as I remember it, a very much of a swing style coat in plaids of green and blue, green and brown. I can see her walking up out of the front door at that school and thinking how beautiful she was. Today she's something like 87 or 88 years old, but still has much of the vivacity of her youth. We had some other interesting teachers at that time, and it is interesting to note that Mr. Carmer had a faculty for selecting people of ability. Today, we seldom know of one of our teachers going on to posts of responsibility and authority in other schools. But it was quite the common thing at that time that after 2 or 3 years, his men teachers especially went on to executive posts, posts of considerable ability. And because I haven't been thinking this out off the hat, I think of Harry Carpenter, who taught math here, who wrote an elementary textbook in science that was used until quite recently and may still be used in many public schools. He went on to teach in the Rochester school system and worked there, I believe, until his death. Another one was there in my day, another science teacher, Mr. Currier, who went on to teach at Penn State. He probably is retired from there by now. Another one who made his name was an ag teacher we had, Ed Babcock, who was the founder of the present GLF. It might be interesting that there were various ways that we could attract rural pupils, into our school. They could basketboard, which meant that they brought staples like eggs and milk, canned fruit, vegetables, and lived in a private family for the week, going home Friday afternoon. Of course, if you were lucky enough to have a horse and buggy, you could drive in for the day, and there were such things as livery stables, like our parking lots today, but undercover, where people could have their horse boarded, cared for, while they were doing other things. And then the pupils could come in by trolley, and they came both from the east and from the west. And the third way was by one horse-drawn bus that came in from the Five Corners area, the school that is now the old, it's a cobblestone home just north of Five Corners on the road.